December 3rd is the International Day for Persons with Disabilities. Today, we learn about the Guelph Accessibility Advisory Committee and the Accessibility for Ontarians with Disabilities Act. Lorelei Root and Aaron Canton are our guests. But first, there was a timely discussion among the four city councillors present regarding the special council meeting on December 5th over the official plan and the issues that emerged from that.
We are honoring the International Day for Persons with Disabilities, which was on December 3rd. One of the things that I got to wake up to this morning was a wonderful article highlighting a very important young Indigenous person. Last Saturday, on December 2nd, Autumn Peltier of the Manitoulin Island community received the Community Hero Award at the 25th Canada Walk of Fame Gala. Autumn is the Chief Water Commissioner of the Anishinaabeg Nation and has been speaking about the importance of protection of water since she was 9 years old. She is now 17. Autumn has been nominated for the International Children's Peace Prize 3 times in 2017, 2018, and 2019. You may ask why, at the beginning of a land acknowledgement, I'm talking about Autumn Peltier. Well, one of the things that we need to do as stewards of this land and treaty partners is ensure the safety of our water and our land. There are some things that happened at council recently that calls some of that into question. And I'm going to ask Phil Ault and Kathy Downer to address the issue.
And thanks very much, Morgan, and thanks to everybody in the restaurant and online. As many of you are aware, this week we repassed with amendments our official plan. After we had submitted it to the province about 7 months ago, and then the province had rejected it, decided to make some significant changes without community input, sent it back to us, told us that we needed to do our diligence and make certain that it was appropriate for Guelph. And I would have to say that we as council addressed that, but perhaps not as successfully as we might have wanted to. I've asked my colleagues, Kathy and Aaron, to comment on this, and in particular to comment on some of the concerns we might have about our water security going forward, our tree canopy, and issues of density and residential development as they relate not just to building more houses, to building a community with a solid economic base. And with that, I think I'm going to turn it over to Kathy because she has a bit of a Christmas project for you to do.
Thanks, Phil. So just a quick background. So many, but I know it's a really knowledgeable group here. The province in its wisdom didn't just do boundary expansions. They meddled with local planning issues around official plans. And in Guelph, they made some, rather than modifications when they sent it back, they sent made like almost like MZOs like for Guelph. And so, 23 stories everywhere in the downtown. Our downtown boundaries go all the way to Huron Street, Dublin, London. So it's not just in what we consider the downtown. There were some other individual properties, and then there was the Guelph Innovation District that they took out over 60 acres of employment lands and added residential. And then Paul Calandra, in his wisdom, came back and said, okay, we're rescinding all of that. We're going to send it back. And we sent it back to the municipalities and the mayors. We're going to reverse that, but we're going to get comment from the mayors first and their staff. And if they want, they can get council endorsement. So Cam, in his wisdom, decided, and I really kudos to him for this. He decided to get input and have a council meeting and report from staff. And I'm just going to talk about the GID lands, because it was a live work community, and what the province had done was what Fusion had wanted, and they had taken out this 60 acres of employment land and they added thousands extra residential. and residential lands. So, you know, Fusion was a pretty good developer. I want to say that at first. I mean, they were looking to make you know, a net zero community and everything like that. But they're still primarily focused on their GID lands. These thousands of extras. So staff raised the red flag and said, no, we shouldn't be turning this around. They said that about everything, actually. We have time to fix the wrong that was done. And so, you know, they raised the issue about, you know, the loss of employment lands, which is significant, because when we did our official plan, like, there's lots of studies done, water studies, employment lands assessment, needs assessments, you know, residential assessments, lots of like $1 million worth of studies go in before you actually create the plan. So we were just barely making, because we have not just population targets, we also have job targets. And so the loss of that is significant. And those employment lands, and it was high quality employment. It was in that secondary plan, it was identified to be innovative, innovation and knowledge base. So much like the research park by the university, and this land was also by close to the university, and it would make the whole community a sort of a live work safe situation. So it was all there. It was clean employment lands. And then, so the additional residential, this is where the other red flag is raised, is that we barely have enough water capacity to make the 208,000 targeted population. That's what in our water study as it is. To go beyond that needs a significant study. So we're looking at another 5,000 to 8,000 people in that area than was planned for. So the CAO and a lot of people are raising the issue around water supply. What will we do? What's going to happen? And staff were saying, we don't need to rush this. We don't need to make this change for Fusion now. In their first phase, this property is developed in blocks. And the first phase, block one, brings on 4,600 homes already. That doesn't include the employment lands. We have time to do the proper studies and work to determine how much employment land they could take away, because maybe there is an option. Employment's changed, right? Maybe there is an option to take some away. And maybe, you know, we can add a bit more residents, but we need to study that. We need to make evidence-based decisions. Well, unfortunately, council decided by a 7-6 vote to just do what Fusion wanted. So we replicated the provincial flawed process by only listening to developers, disregarding staff recommendations, and in the public not really being aware of what's going on, because the report comes out on Friday and the meeting's on a Tuesday at, you know, 2 p.m. There isn't time. We had a deadline of today. And so we replaced their flawed process with our own, in my humble opinion, and did exactly the same thing. We didn't make an evidence. He sent it back to do due diligence, and we didn't do any due diligence on this land at all. And it's not, like I said, it's not about, you know, that I think Fusion is going to do a bad job, but they're interested in their little corner of the Guelph, right? Council should be interested in the whole city and that water supply. So the consequences of this are could be very expensive. So you have to think of, you know, you think of automatically of pipelines, you think of, if we find that we do need more employment lands, we'll probably have to annex for that. So, you know, I sort of envision a time down the road where we are planning in 10 years to annex Puslinch for water and employment lands. And I can tell you, having been through the 1990s when we did the first part of that, that's very, very expensive and costly. So we don't know. We based it on no data provided by Fusion that we could afford to do this in Guelph, that we could afford to increase our population. And it's not just that, there's other infrastructure, and Linda would tell you, schools, like there's a whole new school planning as well that needs to go around this kind of and transit. There's all kinds of things that need to go into studying for that. So I just saying, I don't think this decision can be reversed. We made the decision, and Cam has to write a letter and to the minister. And of course, he was quite happy that everything stayed the same. But ironically, he did say to him, and it was really strange, that, but we might need your help to get more water. So I don't know how the minister is going to receive that. I mean, he sent it back for us to do our due diligence. And then we're saying, oh, yeah, we'll keep all these changes, but you're going to have to help us with water. But we don't know. So I would assume he'd be pretty disappointed that Guelph hasn't done its due diligence either. So I just wanted to put that out there. There is no opportunity really to sort of, you know, I suspect the minister will listen to what the mayor, but, you know, you could write, I mean, if you go to that Environmental Registry of Ontario, it's under Bill 150, and it's one of the first items there. So the ero.ontario.ca, if you write there, the first one is up until December 16th, you can write a letter and you could express your concern about the water, particularly, and maybe the employment land. It's just a significant change without study. It's not a no to them about any of this. It's about, well, let's look at this and see what we can do to help you, you know, achieve your goals and the city's, you know, master, and, you know, keep in alignment with the city's master plan. Let's study this a bit, because they can go ahead and still build housing. So it's not about housing that council did this. They can do that. They've told us they want to have shovels in the ground in 2 to 3 years. And they can still go in and fusion, you know, and build the first bunch of housings while we have time to look at with them what the implications are.
I've got a quick question for you. We've got an incredible organization here in Guelph called Water Watchers. And you're bringing up issue of water. Is this something that we should potentially be asking Water Watchers if they can do some sort of an email blast, which they are so amazing at doing?
Well, Mike Marcolongo is, I've been in contact with him, and so is Phil, and I think he's contacting them. So he's, you know, the question, he's worried that it's writing into a vacuum. I disagree. I think it's an opportunity to raise public awareness. I think this is a pivotal moment, a pivotal decision, just like when we didn't buy the post office. And here we are millions and millions and millions of dollars later for the library back then. We could have built a library for $17 million and we wouldn't be spending $200,000 today fixing an elevator. So, you know, it's those kinds of consequential decisions. And I think I have a feeling, and I've been around a while, that this may be one of them. I don't know. I could be completely off base. This may be okay in the end, but we need time to study it, and we should be making evidence-based decisions. Yeah, so Water Watches would be a good place to go. But Mike is talking to them. I still think letters could go into the registry. It's their first one. It's under Bill 150. So it's that one that you want to write into about Guelph.
Aaron, comments from you, and then I'll go to Linda.
I think it's really interesting that we started off talking about basically a child who's had to do advocacy for her entire life because the adults in the room who are supposed to be making the good decisions aren't doing that. And that is how I feel about what we did recently. I don't think that there was the immediate need to kind of go ahead and push through without going through the studies. This is a very long project that is going to be like probably 10 up to 20 years to complete.
Probably and longer.
The employment lands, yeah, were the last part of it. So there was no reason for us to just kind of throw caution to the wind and ignore all of these studies, because right, like, this is my ward and I'm very excited about this project. I think it's going to be very cool. But I also know that people in my ward have issues with water right now. And that's not going to get better when we add extra, like, thousands of people without the infrastructure in place. And as we all just went through the whole budget process, we know that those are not cheaper. We've got a whole set of rules now with development that make that more expensive for us to accomplish. So I kind of felt when I read the mayor's letter, when he was asking about help with the water, like Kathy just said, that we basically shot ourselves in the foot, and we're like, oh no, now we need all of these Band-Aids too. You know, we're not just going to go down to the store anymore. We just need all these Band-Aids plus a surgery. And, you know, it was our choice as a council, not our, the folks here voted against it, but, you know, like just generally we made the decision as a council, and now we're going to have to live with that choice. And I just think it was really quickly made. And I know that we had no time based on how the provincial government kind of decreed our response time goes. But I think we should have used that opportunity to do it the right way. And as a group, we didn't.
Thanks, Aaron. Linda, I'm going to ask if you could just comment on the issue of sound planning and what the school boards are going to have to go through, or perhaps what they can't go through. And Aaron, you know, I want to point out that an official plan is for a long time. We didn't need to do this in 45 days. We could have permitted a few months, maybe 3 months being reasonable, to allow for a sound consideration. Linda, let's hear about the school boards and other institutional planning as a consequence of this catastrophic challenge we now have.
Good morning, everyone. So I'm going to start first with some planning. So the city did their official plan back in 2022. And as a member of the community, you go out, you do all the surveys, you get your say and everything else. And it was submitted to the minister. And the minister, a year and a bit later, said, we're going to make all these changes. And that's what we discussed on Tuesday. They sent it back to the community after making these unilateral decisions, changes. And most of them, not all of them, were upheld by City Council. And for me, in terms of a planning process, what is most important is citizen engagement, public engagement, and that accountability and that responsibility to go back to the community. I did put in the chat, so I don't know if Phil is able to grab it from where he is, the link. There is a direct link to provide online comments to the changes, and you can do it anonymously. You don't have to put in Linda Buzatil, your email, your birthday, your favorite color. You could just do it as a member of the citizen and say, you know, I oppose the changes because I didn't have an opportunity as a member of the public to comment. And so Phil is absolutely, and Kathy, this happened very quickly. In terms of planning, it's called incremental planning. So you do this and then you check it, you review it, and then you make some changes. And that's what I think councillors, the majority, not the majority, obviously, councillors were saying, let's not make these decisions without these additional studies and plans and things like that. That is what you do. You take stock. You open up your cupboard, you take stock, and then you make your grocery list again. That didn't happen. What Phil is speaking about is, I also want to make a comment, and Kat, maybe Kathy will respond to this. When you kind of erase employment lands and say, this is now residential, you know, I was going to plant the question and ask Kathy, does that change the value of the land?
Talk about the Greenbelt, the $8 billion gift. Well, yes, it's a huge gift. They would have bought that land with that 60 acres identified as employment, which is significantly less than residential. So I don't know what those dollars are, but then also then Fusion gets to make even more because they're home builders. They would be also be making more money because they're building those homes. So, you know, I don't know what those numbers are, but yeah, it was a, you know, anytime we do a zone change, we do that, but we change the value of the land. But in this case, it would be extremely significant, like very huge. So, I mean, I don't want to bash Fusion because I think they're a pretty good developer, and they dealt with the changes initially, but we didn't have to rush that. And they never even delegated. They didn't even come to speak. I didn't get a call from Fusion. So I don't know why we're in such a hurry.
I got a question from Brian Scarrett. I estimate that if we were to have to do a water pipeline, we're looking at something that literally is going to cost billions. Sorry, Brian Holstein, not Brian Scarrett. I don't think I'm far from wrong. Do you recollect what the last estimated cost for a water pipeline might have been? And from there, we can extrapolate.
I think it was going to have to go to Erie for some reason. I forget why.
That must come from the water source to which the river flows.
Yeah. So I think it was well over $1 billion back then. But you got to remember that Guelph bought those targets the council at the time fought those population targets because we didn't have enough water and wastewater supply. And so right now we've just said on a whim, oh yeah, like, you know, another 5,000 to 8,000 people. Okay. Like, you know, above what our water supply can manage. And so it's kind of ironic that we had a council back then that was, you know, went to bat and said, no, we can't manage on our local, you know, our capacity to do this. And this time it was like, what does it matter?
I have heard from some people who were paying attention to the council meeting that they regard this as the absolutely worst decision that this council has made since 25, 30 years ago when we had Mayor Kate Quarry in position. I'll leave that up to other people. But I also want to say something about process. It's very, very clear, like Kathy and me, Linda and Aaron, have real concerns about process and governance. And I want to point out one thing. The responsibility of a councillor is to support a decision of council. Now, what that means to me is I support a democratic process, but I also have concerns about any decision that we make, and I will comment on those concerns at any point. So I'm concerned about water. I'm concerned about employment lands. I'm even concerned about the fact that we are very, very quickly turning Guelph potentially into a dormitory town if we do not develop those employment lands. And I do not feel that when we get behind a process that we are silenced on a particular issue, we still have a duty, actually, to raise concerns about any decision that we've made. Kathy, I don't know if you have any comments, or Linda or Aaron.
Yeah, I think we, you know, council made the decision, so there's nothing that can happen about that. And they've sent off the information. But I do, you know, I still think, you know, as individual councillors, we can still disagree with that decision. I'm not maligning anybody. I'm just saying I don't think this was really thought through. And there's very expensive consequences to not thinking these things through, having been around 100 years like I have. So, you know, when you do these things. So I do really, that's sort of my thinking on that.
Can I say something further on water? Yeah. I just wanted to make that a last comment. So it's not just a pipeline that's going to go underground. I want everyone to picture your favorite park, because it means ponds, water treatment. It means the space around where you live and your community, including your parks, to be turned into infrastructure bearing. Like, where is this going to happen? And I know even here in the West End, lots of pushback and conversations with the city around water and water treatment. So it's contained. It's going to happen. It has to happen somewhere. And there's a cost to it, not only the monetary, but the spatial cost to this. That means things, we're going to lose space. We're going to lose green space because of additional infrastructure that is still considered green, because we're forced to do that. So that's the last piece. And I did want to get to what Phil, I'm no longer with the school board, but yes, when you have huge developments, school boards, because there are four in the city of Guelph, will ask for an option to hold a piece of land to build for future schools. And so, you know, Phil asked the question, and I do happen to know that, you know, the city won't ask for an option until the development is, you know, further along in the process, but that hasn't happened as well. But for me, what is critical is the process. And I will tell you, as a new city councillor, I am ashamed of continuing something that, as a citizen, I was very critical about, the provincial government taking years of community consultation, research, evidence-based, and putting together a plan. I am absolutely behind jobs, absolutely behind housing, but we have to do it in a way, and we've got a planning process. We need to respect that planning process, and that's all I'm going to say on that one.
Okay, and I'm going to very quickly cut this off because we do need to go to our guests at some point. But I would point out that I think that something that we always talk about is reputational risk. And I think that this is a reputational risk to Guelph. We have essentially threatened our tree canopy with this as well. If we create a dormitory community or we do not create jobs in Guelph, how can we go about saying that we are a community that is actually caring for the environment? There are a number of ramifications for reputation that need to be considered, in my opinion. And I think that we need to recognize that everything from how we deal with waste management to water to our tree canopy. And in one, essentially one decision, I think we put a lot of that at risk. And Kathy, it looks like you wanted to say something as well, and then we're going to go to Morgan and our guests.
So, no, I would just say that, unfortunately, Guelph made a decision that benefits a small piece of land and developer. Like, it's like what worked for them, but it doesn't necessarily work for the whole city, and that councillors are vested with that responsibility to look at the whole city and not just one particular developer's interest.
Well, thanks to all of you who are involved in this infomercial about sound planning. I think I'm going to pass it back over to Morgan so that we can hear about what we're really here for, and that's recognizing accessibility rights and this week in particular. Morgan, take it away.
Thank you so very much to Phil, Kathy, Aaron, and Linda for bringing this very important issue to our attention. The information is going into the government today, so we've got to get our letters and information into the ERO. That's Bill 150. Now we get to talk about what we're here for today. December 3rd is International Day for Persons with Disabilities, or Disability Day. It's been observed since the 1992 UN Proclamation and aims to promote the rights and well-being of persons with disabilities in all spheres of society and development, and to increase awareness of the situations of persons with disabilities in every aspect of political, social, economic, and cultural life. That's taken directly from the UN website. Just a couple of facts that I also noticed as I was on the UN website. There are the population of the world is approximately 8 million people. There are approximately 1 billion of those 8 billion that live with some form of disability. 1 in 8. 100 million of those billion are children. And disabled children are 4 times more likely to experience violence than non-disabled children. And finally, the one that I feel the most, 50% of disabled can't afford healthcare. Now, this is worldwide, and I'm pretty sure that it correlates pretty well to the individual. It's worse in developing countries than it is in so-called first world countries. And I think that we just need to recognize that when those of us who have disabilities are accommodated, everybody wins. So today we are lucky to have Lorelei Root, who is the chair of the Accessibility Advisory Committee of Council here in Guelph, as well as Aaron Caton. And she is now a city councillor, and she also sat on the AAC in the past. So we've got some knowledge happening there. First, I wanted to talk a little bit about what the Accessibility for Ontarians with Disability Act is actually about. I went and I took a look at it, and it is so involved that it's way too much for me to be able to get into. So at the very basis of it, the Accessibility for Ontarians with Disabilities Act of 2005 is a statute that was enacted by the Legislature of Ontario. Its purpose is to improve accessibility standards for Ontarians with physical and mental disabilities to all public establishments by 2025. There are 5 standards that are defined by the AODA, and they encompass customer service, transportation, employment, the design of public spaces, and information and communication. So that's a little bit about the day, a little bit about the act. Now we're going to get right into how this functions within our city. And I'm going to call upon our wonderful guest, Lorelei Root, to let us know, what is the Accessibility Advisory Committee? Why do we have it? And what's its function? Lorelei, take it away.
Sure. Hi. Yeah, I've never been here before, so I'll just quickly introduce myself. I'm Lorelei Root. My pronouns are she, her. And yeah, I'm the chair of the City of Guelph's Accessibility Advisory Committee. I also am myself a disabled woman living in Guelph. I've lived in Guelph my whole life. Love it here. And I work with the Canadian Center for Disability Studies. I'm on the board of directors for Guelph Independent Living in an accessibility advisory capacity. I sit on a number of boards and committees in an accessibility advisory capacity. So just so you don't think I'm just some person up here speaking to you today, I do have a lot of lived experience, career experience, and educational background in this topic. But yes, okay, I'm the chair of the City of Guelph's AAC, and accessibility advisory committees are actually something that cities are forced to have. The City of Guelph, because of the size that we are, there has to be an accessibility advisory committee. And what that means is that there are certain decisions that happen within the city that have to come before the committee. Once every other month, we have a meeting and we give our input and advice to council, but more directly, usually to staff, about our thoughts on the changes happening in Guelph. We're really lucky in the City of Guelph that the staff work with us pretty well and bring a lot of things before us that they don't legally have to, because the AODA doesn't actually make the city have to talk to us about very many things at all. While the city, it's important to note that while the city does have to bring things before us for discussion, they don't have to actually implement any of our requests or our feedback that we give to the city. And very regularly, that unfortunately is the case where we will give input and the city will say, okay, thank you for that input about accessibility, but the neighborhood thinks that that would be ugly, or we don't have the budget for that. So it's definitely not a perfect system, but we do our best. And we meet once every other month to discuss things.
Thank you for that brief overview about what the AAC is and what their function is within the city. You were just mentioning about not having to take the advice of the AAC or implement the advice of the AAC. And the first thing that popped into my mind was the conversation that has been happening in communities where I hang out about our parks and about the rubberized surfaces accessibility. I know you and I have had a little bit of conversation about this as well, Lorelei. And I remember your delegation and talking about wood chips. So let's just talk a little bit about the difference between what's in the AODA and what actually works for people. So wood chips, AODA says good. As a wheelchair user, how do wood chips work for you?
I think it's important to make the connection that you said at the beginning of that question that you're talking about things that the city has not received necessarily our feedback on. I want to say the city has been receiving the AAC's feedback on and making changes based on the AAC's feedback on parks and rubberized surfaces. So just to get that out of the way, that's not an example of things that the city is ignoring us on necessarily. They have come to us a number of times, asked us for feedback. I think and hope that that conversation is going to continue. I understand it will. There was a recent council meeting that Councillor Caton brought up a motion, and I think that's coming back before the AAC soon. So that discussion is ongoing, and so far, so good. But there's definitely a lot of change that we'd like to see. But I just don't want to give the impression that the city's not listening to the AAC about that one. Wood chips, I don't know if it's that the AODA says that they are accessible, but there are a number of other documents that we look at when building public spaces. The FADM is another one that we use in Guelph, the Facilities Accessibility Design Manual. And that does say that wood chips are accessible, but disabled users like myself, I've got my wheelchair here, we will be very quick to tell you that wood chips are not accessible for us or for other people. Someone trying to push a stroller through wood chips can be very difficult. you know, actually trying to push a walker or a wheelchair through wood chips can be very difficult. Some people who use electric wheelchairs have a slightly easier time with wood chips, but if it's not accessible for all of us, it's not really accessible for any of us.
I think that one of the problems is with definitions and with language, right? And this is where we get into the difference between like the provincial legislation, different maintenance schedules, and all of the other documents, right? And I think that not having clarity on what really needs to go and get done is one of the bigger issues, right? And we have this not just in our layer here in Guelph, but we have it throughout all of Canada, right? Every province has their own version of the AODA. They're not the same. One of the ways that we're trying to overcome this is by having the Accessible Canada Act that has kind of an overall arching universal design principle, but that's not going to be done until 2040. So there's all of these, you know, stopgap measures that we are kind of trying to get implemented. And I think that just understanding the reality of what's accessible versus what is considered accessible in one document in a corner of someone's room is the big challenge, right? And we found that with the wood chips, because they're listed as accessible, but we all know in practicality they're not, right? So it's just kind of overcoming the, but it says so here, therefore I'm doing a good job. And no one wants to think they're doing a bad job. And I think that accessibility is one of those things that we have to learn that it's not a one and done. Once you reach a certain bar, it doesn't mean that you've kind of covered the whole existence of what needs to be accessible to everybody. And we look at things on a population base and are like, well, only two people need that. I'm like, yeah, but those two people need it just as much as you do. So we need to kind of put the extra energy into that. But I was actually pleased with the first round that I saw of the city's documents when they started adding in the boundaries between rubber surface playgrounds. And so that was a really big first step, because I remember being on the AAC and the conversations that we were having back then. And it seemed, it was like a, it felt like an uphill battle with the education piece. But when they came back with that in the Parks and Rec Master Plan, I was very pleased. And then we had identified extra playgrounds that'll be rubber surface playgrounds. And I'm really looking forward to watching the AAC meeting where you all get to talk about the motions that I proposed that got passed back on to you to give feedback on. Because I think that if we can get some of those policies passed, then we're going to be so far ahead compared to many, many municipalities. And I really look forward to being like a leader in the accessibility space there.
And Aaron, I'm going to let you field this one. Samia has a question about accessible buildings.
So I'm asking this question as I'm a caregiver for my brother, and he's fully dependent on me, and he's 23. So my question is, he's been trying to work, get jobs in Guelph, and most of the jobs that are going to hire him are not inaccessible buildings. So is there a law or like a policy in Guelph, or is the city working on something to like say these buildings that are not accessible, are they going to make them or force them to become accessible? Because there's so many buildings in Guelph, and he's been in this situation for 7 years now. There's so many buildings in Guelph that don't even, they're not accessible, but then there's buildings that don't even have the accessible push the button. And my brother, like, he's paralyzed from neck down. So even if he's using, he can't open a door unless it's accessible. So I just want to know, this is just like a concerned citizen, because the past 7 years, it's been frustrating that there's so many buildings in Guelph that are not accessible.
So first off, the city of Guelph doesn't police the accessibility of all the buildings. So when there is a new building that's going to be built, if it's within a certain, like they just redid this within the provincial legislation, so that when there's a new development, it doesn't go through the ACC site plan unless it's 10 units or more. So commercial buildings would just fall under the Ontario Build Code, and those would be all the new buildings. But if there's an older building, then it's kind of under a grandfathered clause. So it kind of depends. But it wouldn't be the City of Guelph that would be going through that. It would be the province that and the building codes there that you would want to be talking to the folks. But my guess is that you're thinking about a lot of older buildings, and they're not required to upgrade them necessarily. And Lorelei would have like a better idea.
Yeah, I was like, I have some further information on this if you want. So firstly, the site plan committee at the City of Guelph, I sit on that as well in an accessibility advisory capacity. And even the buildings that are newer, that are being built, that are the right amount of units for us to get to look at them, we're only allowed to comment on things like parking and the exterior access to the building. We aren't allowed to actually comment on the things being built in the building. We can make what are called recommendations, but the developers very rarely do anything about our recommendations because they don't have to, and it's usually expensive. However, what I would, if you'd like to connect with me as just a private citizen at some point, I have some resources for you. Under the Ontario Human Rights Code, it's not so much an AODA thing and it's not a City of Guelph thing, but contacting the Ontario Human Rights Commission, employers are required to offer equitable and equal access to disabled individuals who are applying for jobs. So if your brother can't get in the building, they have to offer a different way, like either renting an offsite spot for him or allowing him to work from home the way that I do. And a lot of employers aren't even aware of their responsibilities in that regard. And sometimes it takes some reminding. But definitely there are people who can advocate on your brother's behalf. I can get Morgan to pass that on to you maybe. And I can help you with some resources to advocate, because certainly your brother shouldn't be having to fight to gain access to employment in a city where it's so expensive to live here. And unfortunately, all of the buildings are old enough that the AODA doesn't require them to be physically accessible, but the job does have to be accessible. So
I was wondering if you could please outline how extensive or how limited is the phrase, the duty to accommodate. Is this one that we should take comfort in, or is this one that carries with it some cautions for, say, people like Samia's brother?
It's pretty extensive, actually. I think a lot of people, we get advocacy burnout, and it's very difficult to advocate on behalf of yourself or a loved one. And the amount of hoops you have to jump through to finally get change are monumental. And you obviously know that, Samia. It's exhausting. And so a lot of people, have difficulty accessing that. But the duty to accommodate, they have to prove that there is a massive amount of hardship based on, like, that it would be way too expensive to accommodate someone's needs is pretty much the only way for an employer in Ontario to get out of that. And it has to be a monumental amount of money for them to be able to argue that they don't have the duty to accommodate due to financial hardship. But the duty to accommodate is incredibly extensive. They have to accommodate your brother for employment.
But it's also harder to prove that until you have the job. So like that is the one caveat, right? When you're going around and you're looking for jobs,
yeah,
it's kind of a, how much energy do you have to put into fighting to get that particular job versus like if you were employed by someone and then they were not accommodating you. So there's like the two are a little bit tricky when you're trying to navigate that. But there are a lot of remote jobs right now, because I know, because I'm looking at them. And so there's a lot more of that, and a lot more employers have that option. So that might be something that he wants to look at. And if not, ARCH Disability Law in Toronto are really, really good. And they do work on a sliding scale and offer free legal advice to disabled people.
That is great. Thank you so much for that information. And just as a little bit of an aside on the duty to accommodate, I have a service dog. And that's something that every time that I go into a job interview situation, I worry about how to bring it up. I can only imagine what it's like being a wheelchair user trying to find a position. And especially if it is an in-person job If you can't access the building for your interview, that is a massive problem. Online, we also have a advocate for the underhoused, and her name is Kate Nixon. She's part of your Downtown Guelph Friends. And I just, Kate, I would love to hear what your experience as someone who advocates for a population that has a lot of disability sees this duty to accommodate. Is it something that the underhoused disabled population has access to? Do they understand it? Let us know a little bit about that aspect of accessibility.
Yeah, thank you so much. Sorry, I'm not with you all in person today. I'm just kind of getting over a bit of an illness, but I'm really honored to be here today with so many wonderful folks that are speaking to this very critical topic. I'm really happy to share sort of the perspective of those that are living that are underhoused and unhoused in our communities. And like we were just discussing, in terms of infrastructure, unhoused communities really don't even have access, aren't even allowed to be entering the doors of many places. So imagine navigating, and many of our folks as well are navigating through multiple disabilities, multiple chronic illnesses, various health conditions, and aren't even able to access facilities to navigate through that. So if you can fathom, maybe like for some of our folks with like cancer, or for some of our folks who are needing mobility devices, and also being unhoused, just truly how difficult and frustrating and heartbreaking living like that is, because even if you're trying to just access a building to sit down because you've been on your feet all day and you are battling cancer, or you need to change your colostomy bag or something, so you need to access a bathroom, you're not even allowed to enter the building in a lot of places in Guelph. And that's the reality. And that's because of stigma. That's because of these harmful narratives that we're hearing even at a city level. And it's important to remember that for our folks downtown, that not only is it some of the worst days of their lives that they're navigating, but they're having to do so while also battling health complications and living with various disabilities. So with this duty to accommodate, I just want to say that it doesn't even apply for these folks. It doesn't even apply. They don't even have the opportunity to have to exercise that right, because they often are just shut down just on the basis of being unhoused.
Thank you so much for providing that perspective. And we've got a follow-up question from Phil.
The question actually relates to people living on the street. What proportion of people living on the street would you estimate are suffering from some significant incapacity issue?
Yeah, I would say most of our folks, because I would say probably approximately, if I'm talking about in terms of people who attend our program, I would estimate about 80%. But if I were to say just people that are living unhoused in general in Guelph, I would say about 90%. And because when I look at the folks that are on the streets, that are street involved, sometimes honestly as well, just living in those conditions where you don't have access to basic human rights and basic necessities can cause long-term health complications. So a lot of folks have been living out in the cold for years, don't have access to hygiene facilities, or don't have access to proper nutrition, etc. And that leads to long-term health consequences, which then puts them in a precarious position where they do develop chronic illnesses, or they do develop disabilities that maybe otherwise may have not happened if they had been given the access to the proper human rights that they are deserving of. And so I would say most people, I mean, I see people that are limited mobility who are just in so much pain and suffering from such chronic illness, and it's due to the fact that they've been sleeping on the pavement for like a decade. So, I mean, yeah, most of our folks, I would argue, are suffering with some kind of health consequence.
Okay. And I'm going to go to the money question right now. And that is, we're looking at financial support for people that have some sort of an accessibility issue. What is it like? What do we offer? How easy is it to get? And I don't know whether that's to you, Kate, or to either of the other guests. I know that there's various programs, but I'm constantly hearing those programs don't even begin to touch what a person needs to actually live.
Just before we go to one of the, as a recent applicant to ODSP, I've got to tell you, it's one of the most degrading experiences that I have ever gone through. Having to rehash every bit of disability that I've experienced throughout my life and prove that I deserve to live is not something that I wish on anyone. I was a support for others that were applying on ODSP, and I knew before I started my application how invasive it was going to be. So applying for ODSP, not fun. The amount of money that you get on ODSP, definitely not enough to sustain an able-bodied person.
Yeah, I was just going to say, honestly, in terms of unhoused people accessing those services, I'm sure it's incredibly difficult, because for somebody who has track of where all of their paperwork is and can print off their last 3 months bank statements and their hydro bill and all of that, even that is almost insurmountable, the amount of bureaucracy you have to go through. I'm not on ODSP now, but I was about a decade ago for about half a year, and it's less than a third of minimum wage. So honestly, the conversation really should focus more on the fact that those services that you're talking about, not only are they difficult to access for people who are unhoused, but they are very regularly the reason people are unhoused. Rent is going up, and ODSP has not gone up to keep up with rent and inflation. So it's almost impossible for people who have regular access to a printer and the internet and everything else. Another thought I was having, though, while Kate was talking, is that there's a lot of discussion lately around encampments. And one of the things I keep seeing brought up by the Not In My Backyard folks who want encampments gone, and like, obviously, encampments are not an ideal solution, and there should be better alternatives. But right now, they are a survivable option for people. And a lot of people who are against those are using the disabled community as their reason to be against them. And they'll say things like, well, wheelchair users need access to the sidewalks and things like that. And I see this happen very regularly, actually, in my disability advocacy, where people will pit the disabled community and the unhoused community against each other. Like, let's make the benches unable to be slept on in the parks because disabled people deserve access to those benches. And let's lock the accessible washrooms in every park and you need a key to access them because disabled people... But disabled people are unhoused people. Unhoused people, we are the same community massively. As Kate was saying, massive, massive portion of the unhoused community is the disabled community. And they also deserve access to those benches and those washrooms and those sidewalks. So I personally get very angry when I see especially non-disabled people using my community as a reason to remove rights from unhoused and underhoused folks.
We've got like this brain sink, because as soon as Kate was saying that, I was like, oh, I got to jump in, because I was thinking that exact same thing. And so outside of council stuff, I founded the Environmental Sensitivities Coalition of Canada, and I advocate for a large variety of folks who have environmental sensitivities. And when we think about the city and the duty to accommodate, we go through the County of Wellington as our housing provider, but there is no housing for people who have the most severe of environmental sensitivities. And like, I know loads of folks in my community who either live in their cars or live in tents because the shelters are not accessible to them. Like, if you've got an allergy, if you've got a chemical condition, if you've got any number of these things, you can't actually go to these large group areas. And as a counselor, I've been working with some disabled members of our community on trying to help them through issues getting accommodations in their housing with the County of Wellington, right? Because these things, again, are not set up in the build code properly. We've been advocating for changes to these things for years and years. The AODA is two revisions out of date, not because it was a bad legislation, but because we have an evolving understanding of what people need. And the Ford government has ignored those two reviews. So that's all behind. And then we've got folks who have no money and no place to stay. And like, again, if you look at that Venn diagram of being unhoused and being disabled, we got to remember that addiction is a disability, right? So like, it's a very overlapping crowd, and we don't have situations or systems in place that adequately care for everybody. And even when you're on ODSP, it doesn't cover all of your medical needs. You still have to fundraise. You still have to fight. Like, I've got friends who are wheelchair users going through cancer for the last 6-7 years, and they don't have all of their medications covered. It's a ridiculous system. So, like, I ended up getting chronic fatigue for 2 years in Toronto and was unable to work. And I saw all of the different intersections of where you could potentially fall through the cracks, because they're like as big as the Alora Gorge, basically. There's so many things within our systems that just don't catch people. And then they end up in a tent in downtown. And then you've got folks saying you can't even be there. So it's upsetting to kind of see the system in progress and not be able to fix all the different layers. But we definitely can't punish people for having fallen through so many cracks when we're not in there fixing the spaces in between.
Yeah. It's so expensive to even just survive and exist as a disabled person. Like, if you consider if you're someone who needs a wheelchair, if all of a sudden one day something happens to you and you need a wheelchair, you might think that the government would step in and cover your wheelchair. But ADP is the program that does that. It's the assistive devices program. And they only cover a maximum of 75%. So if you're someone who finds yourself newly disabled and you think, okay, well, 75%, that's a lot. But a very basic wheelchair is like upwards of $20,000. So how many people can just at the drop of a hat afford a quarter of that cost on their own, let alone people who are already experiencing financial hardship?
Yeah. And like, that's one, and that's probably one of the more expensive devices that you would need. But we've got piles of situations, like even my lymphedema machine, because the way that the ADP is set up is that if it's kind of like doing the hokey pokey in terms of your diagnosis. Like, were you born with it? Then we'll pay for it. If you developed it later, then you're like newly disabled. It's kind of a different category. So we're not going to help you there. And so there's things like my machine was $5,000 and none of it was covered, right? If you don't have insurance, and again, even if you do have insurance, it's not necessarily going to cover that whole big thing. So you just have to think, like, how many people have multiple thousands of dollars just put aside so that they can exist the next day when something bad happens to them? Not many.
So I'm just going to move us on. We did have an advanced question from John Fisher that I would really like to address. And it does have to do a lot with what we've already been talking about. Tanya, can you read to us John Fisher's question, please?
Trail user groups have identified curb cuts as problematic for all wheeled trail users. The trail user groups have inventoried all curbs requiring grade transitions for improved accessibility and safety. We know how to make a perfectly accessible grade transition, but the solutions are expensive, and I believe replacements are only planned 3 per year. So John's question is this a case of the perfect being the enemy of the good, And does the city have options that would be agreeable to the AAC that would enable the city to move forward more quickly for the benefit of all wheeled trail users?
We have discussed this a little bit. The 3 per year, I think, that was quoted. I'm not familiar with that number, but I do know that about 4 months ago, the city came to an AAC meeting and talked to us about curb cuts that they were planning to fix for park trails, and that they were planning to fix a very long list of them. And it was my understanding that that was going to be happening pretty quickly. The staff that were in our meeting were like, we were out there today taking measurements. Where are, and I brought up a couple of parks that weren't included in the list that they'd provided, and said, how about these ones? And they added those to the list. So as Morgan mentioned, because there hasn't been an official, I can't give anyone the opinion of the AAC, just because I'm not the whole AAC. I'm just one of us. So I could guess, and I would probably be able to guess pretty accurately what we'd think, but I can't answer the question about what would be agreeable to the AAC. But I do know that this is something that's on our radar, and we've been advocating pretty aggressively for the city to address this issue. I can find out for you the specifics on what the AAC said at that meeting about the curb cuts, because I can't remember it off the top of my head. But I do know that it's something we've been advocating for, and it seems like the city's been they've definitely been very open to all of our recommendations when they've come to our meetings about curb cuts, especially for park trails, when they were redoing the Parks and Rec Master Plan that was brought up regularly. So go ahead, Aaron.
In terms of how many per year, I also don't know that, but I can find out that information by asking staff. But one of the issues that I found with trails is that the curb cut is one part of it, but if the trails themselves are not the right material, or if they're slightly wet, or if there's like any other things, then it's not an accessible situation past that. So they may be prioritizing them on trails that are accessible further down the line versus getting onto something and then it's like a super steep grade that you can't go up anyway, right? So I'm sure that that's kind of being factored into what staff is working on. And I know that they're coming up with a pedestrian master plan to outline all of the missing sidewalks and other things within the city too. And those are all really important initiatives that weren't kind of getting done before, which I think is a really good sign towards accessibility. And even though it may not necessarily be as fast as we want to, because there is the financial issue with any improvement, any infrastructure, regardless of whether or not it's accessibility based, it's not going to be as fast as we want it to be.
And one thing that I'm just noticing here in the comments that goes right along with the trails from Mike Darman is that predictable winter maintenance of sidewalks and trails supports people with disabilities and active transportation users. It's an equity issue. So I just thought I'd bring that into the conversation here. And I am being told that John Fisher has a follow-up. So John, please go ahead.
So there is a federal enabling accessibility fund. I'm wondering whether ACOC or the city has pursued any of those funds. If you've got some examples of that, if you're reaching out for them, but it would be to do with, redoing buildings and public places. So even like adding rubberized mats to the parks or part of the parks, like that could all fall under this enabling accessibility fund. The mid-sized projects are still open. Small projects are closed. But is anybody really going after that to assist the city or assist the accessibility community in making improvements?
Is this something that you have been made aware of as part of the AAC, Lorelei?
Not as part of the AAC, but I do know that the accessibility liaisons for the city or for the AAC, who are the accessibility coordinators for the city, that's Leanne Warren and Sarah Cunnyworth. I know that regularly they're applying to like every grant and every, I'm going to bring that one up though. I have a meeting with them later today and I will find out. Yeah, I haven't heard of the Enabling Fund. Did you say it was called the Enabling
Fund? Enabling Accessibility Fund.
Enabling Accessibility Fund. I'll bring that up today and make sure that the city's aware of it because they're the ones who would be applying for that and bringing it forward. I haven't heard anything of it.
Yeah, I can tell you the deadline for submission is December the 13th, 2023.
Okay, cool. Thank you.
On October the 18th for mid-sized projects, which is, and they're a lot of money, 500,000 to 3 million.
I know so that they're aware of that one because I've brought it up to the folks in finance before because anytime I bring up an accessibility thing that I want done at the city, I try to throw a link to how it can get paid for because initially, you know, if you got the extra funds, then it's problem solved. But they're aware and it's their job to apply and try to get as much funding as they can. Sometimes the government... kind of holds those for nonprofits and other groups. So they've got like a certain portion that they'll set aside for municipalities and provincial things. And then they've got the other side. So that's why we partner with groups like yours and other nonprofits, because you can also apply for funds that we wouldn't necessarily be able to apply for. So that's something that you might want to chat up the staff that you're talking to about other trail issues and see if there's some way to partner up with that.
Thank you so very much for that. And John, I just wanted to make sure before we move on to our next question here and that you don't have any more follow-ups.
Yeah, I think it would be interesting to get a list from the city about how much money they've received from the Enabling Accessibility Fund. I'm always told that we've got an intergovernmental department that is going after funds, but I've seen a couple of examples where they just are not quite imaginative enough in going after the funds and how to tell a story. The Disaster Relief Fund, for example, is one. Where we're putting stormwaters in parks, stormwater ponds in parks, and I was told initially that the city had discussed that with consultants and they didn't think it applied. But if you look at what's going on with that fund and all the municipalities that are getting money from it and the kinds of things they're getting money for includes tree canopies, includes trails, it includes just about everything. So it just takes a little bit of imagination to put together a funding request.
Okay, for all three guests, if they wish to answer, let's get down and dirty because we're now getting to the snowy season. Let's talk about sidewalks, buses, and even multi-use trails and so on. Give us a skinny on how those particular city facilities affect those with accessibility issues.
And just before Erin and Lorelei speak, I am a regular transit user. And one of the things that I notice being out waiting at bus stops is no solid surfaces to land on or launch from. And as my physical state is deteriorating more and more, my ability to launch or land from an unsolid surface is being greatly compromised. Over to Erin and Lorelei.
So I was just bringing my daughter to school, which is why I was out of the meeting for a little bit. And as I was going through, I was looking at all the sidewalks. And this is an issue that's provincial in nature, but then trickles down to the municipalities to solve. We do our snow removal and we do it for all of residential sidewalks. But we've got different timing as to when we'll do that. And we do roads first, sidewalks second. And I think that's kind of a backwards process because most people will need to use the sidewalk at some point. So I think that getting that done first would be like more logistically sound from my perspective. But I understand why we do it because we need to get emergency vehicles from point A to point B. And we also need to get our transit everywhere. So like it's kind of a chicken egg situation where there's no good answer there. But the big issue with sidewalk stuff is the provincial legislation that says 8 centimeters of snow is totally doable. And it's not. It's just really not. And it depends on you and your devices and your ability to get around. So I'll let Lorelei speak more to the experience of that.
Yeah, I was going to say, I don't have very many thoughts on how to fix this problem because it's one that plagues me every year. The first year that I was using my wheelchair, that the snow came around, I hadn't thought it through. I hadn't really realized how much harder it would be to get around in the winter. And I remember the first snowfall happened and it was so beautiful. And I remember later that day, trying to go to just a corner store nearby and being unable to even get someone to pick me up because I couldn't even get to someone's car to get into someone's car. And I wrote a big long Facebook post about how, yeah, the snow is beautiful and I've always loved the snow and I've loved that about living here, but it's no longer just beautiful. It's actually just a prison for me, often for months. And there's a lot of anxiety included of like, will I be able to get to my medical appointments? Sorry. It's hard to get around, I guess, is all I'm saying.
And just to highlight that, Erin, there was an incident with a local community member who uses a power wheelchair last year that you had to rescue. Can you share that with us, even without sharing the individual's name?
Yeah. So there's kind of like, and now it's like an urban myth that I run around saving. Like, this is a friend of mine. So just so we're clear, like, this is someone who I know who is my friend. And he got stuck basically over on Woodlawn and this, and like, he couldn't, and he has a power wheelchair that usually can make it over a lot of stuff. But there's like chunks of ice and things like that. And basically the sidewalk that isn't along residences wasn't cleared enough for his wheelchair to get past. And I live nearby there and he's like, hey, do you know, can you help me? And I started like doing all the city things to see what could be done. And then I was just like, I'm just going to go over there. So I brought my shovel, parked in the bike lane, which I feel bad about, and just started shoveling him out. And this is the problem with the provincial legislation is that the sidewalks were done to provincial standard. It's just not an accessible standard. So you've got, and like, I get financially why it's really hard to do. So that's kind of the crux of being a municipality where you're at the mercy of different provincial legislations, and also you're not getting funded to meet an accessible standard. So the only person who loses in that situation is the disabled person who has no choice but to rely on the public services to be able to get around. So there's a lot of places where advocacy can kind of be slotted in order to make that situation better. But it all starts at the provincial layer.
And when the public services do clear the sidewalks, then homeowners often will go out and not think through the fact that someone in a wheelchair or with a walker might be, or a cane or whatever, might be trying to walk down that sidewalk, and they shovel out their driveway and cause piles of snow on either end of their driveway so they can get out, but people can't then cross. So even when the city does clear the sidewalks, it's almost impossible to get around.
And Phil just has one last question to close us out for today's meeting.
Yeah, and I hope that you don't take this the wrong way, but the question did come up. what is considered to be an acceptable level of snow? What permits people either accessibility or impedes accessibility? And I'm not trying to be smart with that. I'm quite serious. Is it 0, 6 inches? Is it reasonable? Who knows?
So I'll let you go first, Lorelei.
Oh, I was just going to say probably 0, because I think I said this earlier in the meeting that if it's not accessible to all of us, it's not accessible to any of us. And sometimes people with disabilities will come out and say like, oh, this is good enough for me. I can get through 2 inches of snow in my powered wheelchair. So therefore, if the city could just leave only 2 inches, that's accessible. But then someone in a manual wheelchair like myself can't get through that. Or someone who's in their 80s using a walker can't get through that. Or someone who is blind trying to traverse the sidewalks and find the boundaries and the barriers of the curbs can't get through that. So I would say 0 is the best way to be the most accessible to everyone. Because if it's not accessible to everyone, it's not accessible.
Yeah, I would agree with you. Yeah. I think that 0 is the way to go there. And any amount that is over that can also turn into ice. And like, I can dislocate my hip just doing nothing, just going about my day. And if I slip on a little patch of ice, then, you know, I can be out for a couple of weeks. So I don't think that that's a rare occurrence that would happen if you're clearing all the way down to the bottom.
Yeah, there are days that I can like climb over a snowbank. Like I'm an ambulatory wheelchair user, so sometimes I walk and sometimes I have to use my chair depending on how my disability fluctuates. But I would still never say that the days that I can walk are the good standard for accessibility.
Okay. Well, we have reached the end of our discussion. I think we have covered a lot of ground, not only with accessibility, but also with some of the things that are happening amongst the council and provincial governments. Thank you so very, very much to Lorelei and Erin for being with us today, as well as all the people who have contributed to the conversation. Kate, thank you for being with us to be able to provide a bit of perspective for the under and unhoused community. I'm going to turn it over to Tanya for announcements.
Okay. Hi, everyone. There is the last council meeting of 2023. Tuesday, the 12th of December at 6:30 p.m. And on the agenda is the Affordable Housing Strategy Report. And in honor of Festivus, there will be the airing of grievances regarding Jane Field. On December 14th at the Guelph Civic Museum, there will be a storytelling event. The doors open at 6:30 and the start time is at 7 p.m. And next week on Breezy Breakfast, we're talking books and movies with Steve Kraft, Adam Donaldson, and Candace LePage. And with that, I believe it's a wrap. Thank you to our guests, and thank you all who are here today, and we'll see you next week.
Thanks for tuning in. Music provided by Jules Germ and post-production by Scotty Hertz. Breezy Breakfast at the Rise and Shine, where food for thought is accessible to everyone.